Most of the crime that's committed by adults is committed by people under the age of 25. And they did not start at 19 years of age committing crime. Most of those people were active juvenile delinquents.
Stick everything out of your pocket. Stick them up on the counter of your belt. Hat, watches.
Some of the more serious offenders that I've had the chance to meet and to work with have been individuals severely neglected by their families. Had been out on the streets at a very early age and had been in serious problems and spent a lot of time in institutions.
Keep your hands on the counter, spread your legs, step back.
Without a decent set of parents, a kid doesn't have much of a chance in this society.
The Garner Ted Armstrong Program. Radio and television commentator Garner Ted Armstrong takes a look at today's troubled youth. Juvenile crime. Can we prevent it?
Ever since Cain killed Abel, society has been trying to discover why youthful crime. Why homicides in families? And why is a major percentage of murder happening in the home between brothers? Brother and perhaps sister, between child and parent, between cousins and uncles and husbands and wives? And why is it in our mountainous wave of juvenile crime and youthful violence that we see increasingly the age categories popping up in some of the most brutal of all crimes and some of the most oft-repeated crimes, from auto theft to arson to murder, burglary, armed robbery, and rape, are being represented by 15, 16, 17-year-old youths? And why do we also see hardened criminals 25 and over who have been arrested perhaps 25 or more times since they were about 11 or 12 years of age? The entire question, the problem, the mountainous national shame of juvenile justice, as it's called, has been a source of never-ending question to society in general. It's costing us millions, hundreds of millions of dollars per year. We want to know why. Is it because the kids come from the ghetto? Because they represent a certain ethnic group? Is it because of underprivileged childhood? Is it because of broken home and family? Why? People want to know the answer. In our research for these programs, we discovered there are some projects to prevent youthful crime. They're called diversionary projects. We talked with Justice William Hogeboom and asked him the question, what is the greatest need in juvenile justice?
Well, early diagnosis intervention, I suppose, is the main one. We don't attempt to find out who the potential delinquents are, and yet we know rather well the kinds of things that happen at a very early age that indicate later delinquency. Early diagnosis and treatment, early diagnosis of learning disabilities in particular, would be something that would help a great deal.
Early intervention and more appropriate intervention is going to serve the community, certainly, more effectively and at much less cost, but even more important is going to help that youngster and his family, who after all this whole system was supposedly designed to help. I guess the analogy would be one of preventive medicine or early intervention in the medical problem. The same thing holds true, I think, when you see disintegration of a family beginning to take place. It certainly seems ludicrous to me to wait until a child is forced into a blatantly delinquent pattern of behavior before the system can mobilize itself to pay attention to him.
Well, diversion has been going on for a long time. The philosophy is to keep youth out of the juvenile justice system, to treat them in the community. They feel it's more effective. As you know from recent stats coming out, a lot of youth going through that juvenile justice system are recidivating, going back in. And so that's one reason, or one philosophy. The other philosophy is more in terms of economics. It's cheaper to treat a youngster in the community. And the various funding sources that are providing funds for diversion projects are looking at that very closely. We can keep a youngster in the community and serve them for one-tenth of the cost of sending a kid into an institutional setting.
One of these diversion projects is located in Pomona, California. Project Upstream is a 2.5-year-old experimental program set up by Boys Republic, a private school and training center for boys with behavior problems.
Project Upstream is a contracting agency that we're working with. Our project, for the most part, subcontracts with community-based agencies in the area. And they're an agency that's very strong in dealing with junior high youngsters, trying to keep them out of trouble. They get most of their referrals from the schools, where the schools are identifying kids that have had behavior problems, serious academic problems, and they provide a lot of very strong services, primarily in the field of counseling. And they are one of the agencies that really gets into the families and really deals with those families and tries to get them involved in solving the problem, trying to reach the total environment.
Project Upstream is run by Pete Burns and his wife, Joanne. Our film crews went along on a family counseling session with the parents of Frank, one of the boys who was in Project Upstream.
My name is Peter Burns, and this is my wife, Joanne, and we're from Boys Republic. And Boys Republic has a program in the community called Project Upstream. And we're working in conjunction with the Pomona Unified School District. And Frank here is going to Emerson, as you well know. And I don't know if the school has contacted you in regards to our program.
And, yes, they have.
Okay, and having Frank get involved. What we're trying to do is we're trying to help Frank to make some adjustments in his school. He's having some problems in school, and we're trying to help him to make the adjustments. We'd like to talk to you a little bit about Frank and how you feel about his problems, if you think he's having any, and also if you want him to get involved in what we're doing. Could you tell us a little bit about the problems you see Frank may be having, whether they be in school or at home?
He's having trouble all the way around because of his attitude and what he's gone through. He's gone through a divorce. And then it wasn't too long, much later than that, that I was in an accident and he was left there. Then we came to California. He was uprooted and brought here. I have got to go to work now. He's used to me being home. I'm working with the help of my family. My brothers and sisters were making a go of it.
Frank, could you just maybe tell us a little bit about it? What kind of problems you think you're having in school?
With teachers fighting with them, and arguing, kids at school fighting with them.
And did she?
Yeah.
Let me say to you, Frank, are you interested in trying to get involved in something to maybe help yourself out?
Yeah.
You think you need some help? Joanne, maybe you can read back what the school says in terms of Frank's problems.
Well, basically, Frank, it's the same thing we talked about the very first time that we met at school, and that's that Mr. Adams feels that the truancy is the biggest problem. He gets so often that they can't deal with your problem behavior. And the other problem that they really are concerned with is the companions you keep. You hang around with older guys, and they seem to have a negative influence on you. And Mr. Adams feels that if you did come to school more often, and if you cut out with some of the negative friends that you have, he could possibly work with you. And that's kind of what we'd like to offer you in our program.
How do you feel about Frank getting involved in something like this?
Anything, so long as it'll keep him out of trouble, straighten him out, and let him accept responsibility as it comes.
Let me also add that part of the package is that you make some commitments in terms of getting involved when we asked you to, and also giving us some feedback on Frank in terms of what he's doing at home. We'll be perfectly willing to come by and sit down in a family group situation and discuss what the problems are and see if we can find some solutions to the problems or some alternatives.
Problem, Frank, at this particular time, is involved with a lot of females in his home situation. And his mother and his mother and his aunt are really trying to do a good job with him. They're really trying to get Frank to understand that he's destroying himself if he continues to do the things he's doing. His mother feels that he needs a masculine image. She feels that Frank needs some support from a man. And Frank talks about that a little bit himself. You know, he liked his dad, and I think it really broke him up when his dad and his mother separated. And I think that's part of his problem right there.
Charlie Taylor thought they were delivering a new TV set.
I put new locks on the doors.
And we weren't gone for very long.
Why, they came in broad daylight.
I didn't think we had that many things worth stealing.
We've got lots of reasons why a crime couldn't happen to us, but it can and does. This informative free booklet, Crime Can Be Stopped, gives you valuable ways to help protect your home. Dial direct 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. Remember, no one is immune to crime.
Young people get involved with a project like Project Upstream usually when the principal or the vice principal or the counselor at their junior high or high school notices, because of various problems in school, whether it's damage of school property or altercations of one type or another, and of course the truancy problem. But this always, they find, goes hand in hand with poor performance, underachievement, in other words, just plain low grades in the school.
There might be anywhere from a semester behind to 4 or 5 years behind. We've had some young people who are 13 to 14 years of age and they're non-readers, don't know the alphabet. They're just more socially oriented than academically oriented. When you meet that person, when you talk to that person, they're very conversant, they're very verbal, they're very much aware of what goes on in a social world. But the academic world, they don't even begin to try and cope with that.
Most of the people you find in institutions, I would say 80%, are probably suffering from learning disabilities. This is true almost every place. Now, this is not to say that if you cured all learning disabilities, you wouldn't have violent people. I don't mean to indicate that. But a lot of the early frustrations of juveniles that land them in difficulty with the juvenile law are a result of the frustrations that are felt family-wise, school-wise, and others, and learning disabilities would be very high on the list of early causes, I think.
Each morning for 3 hours, Upstream has a certified teacher from the local school system teach a remedial educational program covering basic math skills, writing, library usage, social studies, history, and other basic skills needed in the school system. Group evaluation and confrontation is the core of the Upstream program. During group, the individual's actions are interpreted by others who offer suggestions or solutions to problems.
I'd like to just to have people speak up and evaluate Frank. So I'll kind of start it off and just say positive, Frank. I really like you as a person. I think you're a good person. I think you got a lot of good things that you can do to help other people. And negative, I see you getting into a lot of things that really demonstrate that you're just getting real shady, and you're sneaking around, and you're lying, and you're doing a lot of things that are just not acceptable. And I guess what makes me feel bad about it, Frank, is you know what you're doing.
If you want to stay, you're going to have to do a lot of work to stay here. Improving stuff. That's how I feel. In my opinion, you've been spending more time out in the community with the same partners that used to get you in trouble when you were in public school. You know? This is getting you in trouble again. You quit making decisions for Frank and you're letting somebody else make them for you. You're involved in a lot of things that I don't think you feel too good about, or you bring them up in a group situation. Okay?
Positive. I see you sometimes coming in real happy and stuff. Like today you were in it looked like a good mood. You're fooling around with everybody and having a lot of fun. But, like yesterday, I don't know what happened, but I don't like how you and Paul tipped up over all those chairs and stuff because we had cleaned it up, me and Rachel, and I don't like that.
When you first came into the program, I really thought you were a nice guy. And I saw you doing a lot of nice things, working in the afternoons with the kids from the elementary school. But, flat out, I just think you're just acting like a 14-carat chump most of the time. But, you know, I think you have some mistaken ideas about how bad you are, Frank. I think you're just a kid. And I suggest to you that if you're going to continue acting the way you're acting here, that you go out into the community and act that way. Because here, we have to let you get away with it. But in the community, somebody's going to jack you up.
Now, here's a student that has a possibility. Here's a possibility of this student coming out of, you know, the negative, aggressive, hostile type of behavior, the delinquent, even semi-criminal type of behavior. He knows he's doing it. He understands that he shouldn't be doing it, but he also realizes that there is a possibility for help for him. So he continues to try, and as long as he tries, we'll try.
Most important, though, is the question of success in this project. What defines a successful delinquency prevention program?
Well, the community really does it for us, the school people in particular, and they've defined success for us now primarily as this youngster is able to learn better, he or she is much less disruptive in the classroom, they're getting along better in the community and with their peers. These are the general kinds of feedback we get from the school people about success. And the kids themselves, of course, tell you they feel better. You can just see in their own activity what's happening.
How would you rate Upstream as far as, is it a success?
Every person has their own successes and their own failures, which are unique to their own personality. And a whole program like this, because it is a delinquency prevention program, is geared towards catching a young person at the right time when they're ready to make the change.
Dr. Holman, how successful is Project Upstream?
The feedback we get from the school people and the law enforcement people is highly positive. I think when we started out, we were running a success rate maybe below 50%. I think now the data that we have on the group we had last summer, was that we're being successful with more than 3/4 of the students. There's been a steady improvement. In addition to the greater success in this kind of environment, the cost factors really are much in favor of it. It costs about as much to one child year in an operation like this is about equal to one child month in a residential facility like juvenile hall or one of the work camps. So it is both more successful and it costs less money. It does not work with everybody. Some of the kids simply can't be dealt with in this kind of environment. They're too hard to handle. For those who can, it's both economical and more effective.
It's all a matter of priority. We claim to be a child-oriented society and concerned about our youth, but when it comes time to vote on the issues or perhaps to release the purse strings to budget for similar projects such as this, such as Upstream and other projects, it seems to be very difficult in doing so, even though these are proving far more cost-effective than foster homes and lockups.
Pioneer 10 races out of our solar system while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion while over 15,000 people starve to death worldwide each day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For your free sample copy of the monthly Plain Truth magazine, call toll-free 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Well, it all begins in the home. That's the emphasis I've placed on this problem ever since I began doing programs on The World Tomorrow 20 years ago on radio, and the first telecast that I did on the subject of juvenile delinquency in 1955. The home is the building block of society. That's where it starts. Only in the home can a child receive healthy emotional, psychological, social, and educational foundations that are going to last him for the rest of his life.
The assumption by society that the courts are going to solve the problem is a naive one. That if you send the kid back out to a family life that, you know, the parents are alcoholics or drug addicts or irresponsible and immature, and there are street gangs and drugs and guns and it's like curing somebody of malaria and then sending them back out into the jungle. You have to do something about the home life of those youngsters, and also the larger environment of the youngster in terms of the values of American society.
Parents
also have to spend more time with their children. They have to not necessarily select the type of exposure. I think they have to ask the child, what would you like to do this weekend? Or what kinds of things would you like to get involved in? We have some time and we'd like to spend some time with you. In many cases, also, parents never get a chance to meet their children's friends. They don't even know who they are. And things of this nature. It seems to be just a simple matter of getting involved with your child.
You'll get some very, very well-intentioned parents that have delinquent kids. But many times they haven't had the time because they're out there working the 8 and 10 and 12 hours a day, a very difficult job, and just don't have the energy to take care of their kids the way they should. But they're well-intentioned people. They haven't got into trouble themselves, but their kids, being independent at 6 and 7 years old, venture off.
A large percentage of the kids that come through our department who are hardcore delinquents, when you look at their files, we keep cards with every contact so that when we see a child, we know if we've seen him before and we know why. Vast majority have been to us as very, very young children, as either the victims of neglect or abuse, or have been sent to us for problems that are labeled things like incorrigibility or status offenses, and that would include running away or truancy or curfew violations or those kinds of things. That's where it starts, and those are not criminal acts, but I think what they are signals that something is very, very wrong in the life of that child and in the life of that child's family.
And I think the other thing that's important about that love is that babies are loved because they're babies. But people are loved because of their personality. And if you don't love my personality, if you can't love me as a person, if you can't tell me that, then I'm no good. My self-worth is just down to nothing. And I think that young people have to be reassured of that okay, I know you love me as a baby because you didn't have any choice, but now I'm me and I've got braces and I've got acne and my hair is not as long as it should be and I'm just not the perfect young person. Do you still love me?
I asked a parent one time, I said, when's the last time you told your son that you loved him? Oh, yeah, he knows I love him. I just bought him a car last month. I said, that's not my question. When was the last time that you told your son that you love him? The man could honestly not remember when he said those three words to his son, I love you.
Not everybody can get a driver's license. You have to take tests and so on and qualify physically, mentally, and so on. But anybody can be a parent. And it's probably the most crucial role that anybody can play. I think there's a need for professionals to give guidance to a family that's trying to regroup and improve itself. But to me, that's the strength of our society. And I do see it disintegrating, unfortunately.
What disintegrating?
The family.
Even though, as a mother, I gave birth to my daughter, she's still an individual. There'll be a lot of things about her personality that I may not like. There'll be a lot of things about her personality that I wished could have been different. But she is an individual, and you have to be able to give a young person room to grow and offer them alternatives that are obtainable for them, things that they can feel that they can reach.
Another case, this young girl was in juvenile hall for running away from home. Just a minor offense that had a parent shown up, she would have been able to be returned to a family. And she got out into the courtroom and she was very excited and she was looking forward to going home. And neither parent showed up in the courtroom. Well, the father, it appeared, was out of state. The mother got on the phone and the mother said, listen, we don't want her. Why don't you just keep her there in juvenile hall? You know, you can have her. And naturally, I had to pass that message on to this little girl and she just shattered in front of me, just started to cry and convulse, and I wanted to get down from the bench and put my arms around her and really, you know, show me human emotion and affection that she needed. And my prognosis in the case of this young girl is that eventually she will be found overdosing, or she will be, you know, a suicide case, that without a decent set of parents, a kid doesn't have much of a chance in this society.
I've seen time and time again 6 and 7 children out of the same family entering the juvenile justice system. So if you see that Johnny's brother and sister and nephew and niece, cousin, have all entered that juvenile justice system, you may be worried that he may be headed in that direction.
Some of our students say to us, my mother doesn't love me, or my father doesn't love me. I think the concept of parent-child love is taken for granted a great deal. The love isn't demonstrated. You know, when a child says that to the parent says, well, yes, I love you. Of course I love you. But they haven't been demonstrating that love. We've seen young girls in our program like that. They're not getting that kind of the kind of love they think they should be getting at home, so they go out and get it in the streets, and that's very dangerous.
How effective a parent are you at home?
Well, I have several barometers that I rely on, and I guess the most accurate one at this time is my seven-year-old son. I'm contemplating going back to school, for instance, and doing some advanced education. And I was talking with my wife about this and had been accepted into a program and was quite excited about it. And it was a Saturday morning, I was in the bathtub reading the paper thinking the world was fine, and my six-and-a-half, seven-year-old son came in and says, Daddy, are you going to be going to school on Saturdays? You know, my wife and I hadn't mentioned this. And I said, I think so. Why do you ask, Jay? And he said, because I don't want you to. That's a very important statement from that child. Very important. And it has forced me to reconsider my priorities and to decide where my priorities lie. Because at 7 years of age, that youngster is saying to me in a fairly direct way that he needs some of my time. But I think when your kids say those kinds of things to you, you better listen. Because if you don't, when they're 13, they're going to be running away, and when they're 15, they're going to be involved in alcoholism or narcotics, and when they're 18, they're probably going to be in jail.
Your home is where society begins. Right there on your living room carpet in front of television could be prospective juvenile delinquent. Because most homes in America are like glorified motels or hotels where the parents come and go at their own pace and their own schedule. Too many of them are broken by divorce or separation, approximately one out of three, sometimes every other home in the big city environment, and especially in certain ethnic groups because of underprivileged conditions, impoverished conditions, the ghetto conditions and the like. There are hideous imbalances in American home situations, and this really is at the root and the core, the cause of juvenile crime and violence. It all begins in the home. The one main way to teach your child is by parental example. And your child needs not only the life you gave him because he is yours or she, but they need you. They need your time, your concern. They need your love and your affection. We're trying to help with this enormous nationwide problem, not only by bringing it to your attention and the attention of millions of Americans and people in other countries, but also by providing the tools in the simple form of this publication and others like it, of booklets and articles on the subject that can get you started. Maybe as you listen to some of these kids and some of the people, you've had some pangs of conscience about your situation. Well, do yourself a favor and pick up that phone right now and dial the toll-free number 800-423-4444. It could save the life of a child.
For the free literature offered on this program, write Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. Or in the continental United States, you may call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. In California, dial direct 213-577-5225. All literature is free upon request.